It's hard to find one theme in Rick Bass's new collection of essays. I mean, they're all written over the course of nearly 30 years. Bass is a writer and an environmental activist, so maybe the unifying element is the planet itself. Over the course of his career, Bass has managed to fold his interest in ecology with literature, and the writing part may have really started in Utah. Bass told us he was studying wildlife sciences at Utah State, and he needed some credit hours. So on a whim, he took a short story class.
I remember the poster in Old Main in the hallway, Southern Writing. It had a picture of a mule on it, and Zora Neale Hurston's book of Mules and Men was one of the course selections. And I thought, well, heck, I like to read. So I thought I'd take that short story appreciation class. I had never had any experience to the world of writing before, and it was magnificent. He kept talking about a writer named Flaubert, and I thought he was talking about some Native American chief. I just didn't know anything. And then there was also a class about nature writing, and yeah, they did change my life. They just poured, you know, sunlight into darkness. I was really lucky. The spark was when I got down to Mississippi and was working as a geologist and would go to bookstores, you know, to buy books, which is what book addicts do, reading addicts do. And the booksellers would just keep hand-selling books. And I read so many of the Southern writers, so many of the Russian writers, so many of the what were later called nature writers. They kept trying to push off this book on me called Legends of the Fall by Jim Harrison. And I'd look at it, and on the back there'd be a picture of this one-eyed, goofy-looking hulk of a man lying down in the grass with his daughter, and he looked like he'd passed out drunk and was just not taking life seriously. And his bio said, Jim Harrison, 41 years old, is an outdoorsman and a man of letters. Every time I read that, I just put the book down and say, you can't be an outdoorsman and a man of letters. And if you're a man of letters, you don't go around saying you're a man of letters. And this is just going to be a book about blood and matted fur. I wouldn't buy it, and they finally gave it to me. And that title, Novella, was really the spark.
How do you describe your time in Utah? I've read about you going off into the Utah wilderness on the weekends, just taking books with you, taking a sleeping bag with you, and basically nothing else. Clearly, you have a fondness for that time.
Oh, gosh, yeah, yeah. A person would have had to have lived for 18 years in Houston to fully appreciate Utah, I think, the way that I did and do. I didn't know such a world could exist. Growing up in Texas, you hear, you know, there's a myth, a culture of frontier, you know, to the west, and whatever that looks like to different people, you know, open spaces and room and prairies and mountains and deserts and rivers and forests. And Utah, of course, has all of those things. And it was a fairy tale. It was like, yeah, this is what they were talking about. This is what I crave and love. The cultural element of it was also a great gift to me, to be a Gentile, you know, a non-Mormon in Mormon country, as Stegner would say. And that's just a great thing for an 18-year-old Texan, is to be not in the majority, to be a visitor in another country. It was kind of the best of all worlds for me. I was a little rough around the edges, I guess, as most young men are. And to be in such a safe bosom of Abraham, where everybody was law-abiding back in the day, and then for me to be kind of pushing the edges of things, it's like a safe place to be a bit of an outlaw. I got really lucky with Utah.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rick Bass's new essay collection is called With Every Great Breath, and he's joining us for the hour. He gives the activist in him a bit of a rest in the collection. He writes that in the midst of a war, you have to talk about war, but you also have to talk about beauty, and that's probably the real focus here.
Beauty is the secret sauce for putting one step in front of the next each day. And
it's not an, to me, it's not an either or position that, oh, one cannot be an activist if one is not embracing with greatest exertion the despair and futility of the moment. I think you can do both. I think you can be stupendously awed by beauty that you encounter and not lose your fastball as an activist. I think there's just a real tendency for us as activists to, stay down in the grind, stay down in the pain, stay down in the grief. And over time, the cumulative effects create a tonality that is off-putting and destructive to, what Thomas Merton would call the inner peace, the frenzy of the activist, he called it. And so I wanted to kind of look back and say, oh yeah, I remember that person. I remember that guy. He loved the world. He loves the world. And not be threatened as an activist by my looking back at those things.
Well, you write this. You write that in the midst of a war, one has to write or speak about war. But one has to write or speak about beauty, too. So why? Why, though? Why does beauty have to come along in a conversation when you're thinking about, writing about, feel like you're in the middle of a war?
Well, I don't like using military terms, and I've been trying to scrub them from my vocabulary, but some things just are what they are named. And I think it would be silly and false to not refer to this moment in this country and in the world as a war against a great many things. I think the painter and writer Russell Chatham has a beautiful explanation of it. It's from an essay called Letter to a Young Painter. The artist does not simply hold a mirror to society, he has written. If the world now is greedy, the artist must be generous. If there is war and hate, he must be peaceful and loving. If the world is insane, he must offer sanity. And if the world is becoming a void, he must fill it with his soul. It's about how things are composed of their opposite. The opposite gives perspective. I mean, the broad Hallmark card cliche would say you can't have sunlight without darkness and that kind of thing. And so war has to have a strand of beauty in it, and beauty has to have the threat of war in it to be felt as sharply. You know, when you love something, you are going to fight for it. And remembering that the essence and the identity of the thing you love, which is, often limbed with beauty, that's important to be a good battler in defending it. You have to remember why you're defending it, not just get locked into the fight itself.
One of the things you do in the book is you center your reflections of beauty on, at least in one essay, on birders. And you describe birders as, this is how you put it, veterans of beauty. What do birders know about beauty?
I think they know an exquisite integration of the five senses. They seem like, as do hunters, only even more so, seem really dialed in and wired to the moment. Their senses are aflame, their sense of hearing, their sense of sight, the scent, the direction of the wind, the feel of the ground underfoot, approaching the thicket quietly, avoiding the crunchy leaves, staying in the sand. They become their prey. They become their quarry. They are like birds themselves in seeking them. It's trippy.
And then there's this part in that essay where you wonder, and this is how you kind of lay it out. You wonder whether or not one day you will feel tired and worn out, and how at this point your imagination, you say, may dim, and how this might affect the way you fight a fight or advocate for a cause that without your imagination, you say you might not be able to envision a way to win. And I wanted to ask you about that because it seems like what you're saying is that there is a connection between using our imagination and beauty in the way we fight. Like it's an we have to be imaginative in this in the things we advocate for. Is that what you're getting at?
Absolutely, and at least in my personal and specific circumstances and experience, and I would imagine it's that way for each of us, whatever our battles are. But certainly in my own cage match against the U.S. Forest Service, that is what I have that they don't have, and that is whatever I can do to bring creativity and imagination to the struggle that plays to my strengths and into their weaknesses. And it's imperative just from a tactical standpoint to remember that. But it also, you know, rejuvenates me, the battler, which I don't want to be, but, you know, in for a dime, in for a dollar, you're gonna fight for what you love. You know, just as ferociously as you would fight an editor over a punctuation decision. And I think that's what I was concerned about losing was my efficacy, my spirit, my imagination, my joy in the thing that I'm fighting for. And that if I can jump ahead and maybe take two or three of your questions away from you by continuing to ramble with a monologue, it really plays to an incredible battle that I'm involved in right now to protect this ancient forest up in the Yaak Valley, in the northwest corner of Montana. It's this incredible ancient inland rainforest. And back during the previous administration, chief executive had directed the Forest Service to increase volume by 40% and do away with scientific review on their timber sales. And that's what led to the birth of this monstrous project called Black Ram. And we went in there to examine, you know, ground truth the units, and Forest Service had already spray painted all the trees, you know, 20 and 30 foot tall stripes of bright blue spray paint, orange, yellow, you know, on these 500-600-year-old trees, just a desecration if ever there was one. And they had already built a clear cut to the edge of the units that they were going to go into and clear cut. And they'd knocked over a tree, or a tree had fallen over, a giant spruce tree, 315-year-old spruce tree, once it lost the support of its cohorts at the edge. We thought, we have to do something different here. We have to change the playing field. We have to change the rules. We have to change everything. And, you know, our first impulse, our response was rage and despair. And I just thought immediately, like, wait, we lose a lot of fights this way. This feels really familiar. Like, let's do better than rage. Let's find what's beyond rage. And you go in the opposite direction and you find joy and creativity. And so I made a hard veer in that direction and away from rage. And it felt good. And we cut a big chunk of about a 4-foot length of wood out of this enormous spruce that had tipped over. We cut it down near the base where it was stronger, tighter grained, no knots, or where the wood was really clear, and wheelbarrowed it out. And we put it in the front seat of the Subaru and drove 465 miles to Bozeman, where this incredible master luthier, Kevin Kopp, builds a few guitars each year for the likes of Leo Kottke and other, you know, guitar virtuosos. He's got like this standing wait list, you know, for years and years in advance for the very few instruments he makes. And he had agreed to make a guitar for us out of a piece of wood from this ancient rainforest defending. And it took him about a year, but he did make it. And it is a thing of, you know, forgive the cliche and the abstraction, a thing of beauty. The grains are so tight together and the wood is so beautiful and it's so rich and resonant. And he did such a great job on the guitar. It's a 7/8 size guitar. It's a Nick Lucas model, but he's modified it with his own alterations, and it has a larger sound hole to compensate for the smaller body. And the tone that comes out of it sounds like a much, much older guitar, really rich already. And we're taking that guitar around the country for musicians to play a song of resistance or celebration on it, you know, and ask them to talk a little bit about why they choose the song that they choose to teach to the guitar, who is, having been 315 years a tree, is now 1 year a guitar. And so it's a really wonderful project, and it's really fun to see the musicians play a magnificent instrument.
I'm not sure if I'm overthinking the connection here, but you mention rage, and there's this essay in the book about the serenity beneath the rage of a competitive weightlifter, the Squat King. Fred Hatfield is his name. Dr. Squat is his nickname.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if there's a connection. The rage part made me wonder. First of all, what made you want to write about Dr. Squat?
That's a great question. I thought he was really trippy. He was so old and so stinking strong and so just insanely obsessed with his passion. I think obsession is a fascinating topic to observe. One wants to avoid it in one's life, but we love a train wreck. It's fun to stand at the edge of obsession and peer in. And he certainly was obsessed.
So this sentence threw me off in that essay. It's the first thing we come to. You write, back when I was a competitive weightlifter, and it made me think, you were a competitive weightlifter? Because I'm having a hard time making the connection between your writing or maybe your persona and you being a competitive weightlifter.
You know, if we're fortunate, we get to live many lives.
Yeah.
And I was big into football. I played football and I loved moving heavy things around. It was a great pleasure. I can remember those days. You know, you'd be monitoring your own weight like a falconer, you know, with his or her hawk and, you know, down to the ounce, and you'd be, you know, wanting to make weight class and you'd be daydreaming and, you know, in class in college, planning ahead to your next workout, you know, okay, what am I going to do? How many reps, what weights and what lifts? But I loved it. I mean, they were just, once you do anything to a deep extent, you just get to know it really intimately. And that's kind of one of the great qualities and conditions of being alive. But I mean, I'm daydreaming, remembering it now, like on the squat, once you get over about 400 pounds, the bar starts to, bend a little bit. It has some flexibility. You don't think of it as having flexibility, you know, steel bar. But when you put enough weight on it, it does begin to bounce, you know, flex. And you time that, you feel that bounce, that bend going on in your descent, and you time your bottom of your descent to hit the bottom of the bar. So you're kind of a resonance or harmony with it. And then you come up on the upstroke as it's releasing of its downward bounce. And it's like getting 25, 35 extra pounds lift just out of such a subtle awareness of timing and weight on your back. It was fun. It was fun. I have no desire to return to it, but it was fun back then.
Rick Bass, his latest book is With Every Great Breath. When did you first go hunting? You remember?
I would hunt with my dad and family in Texas in high school, quail and deer, turkeys in the Texas Hill Country, which was what passed for wilderness and was my introduction into the idea of wild country. And not just the idea, the physicality of rough land, you know, places where you could get lost. And I mean, you get lost in Texas, you go to a fence and then you follow the fence to a gate and the gate's going to be at a road.
Right.
For a young person, it sufficed. But the other kind of hunting I didn't experience until I was in Montana, where you can walk out your door and go days and nights on end on public land and see anything in the world. And eventually, usually did. You would see something amazing every day and seek ever deeper, wilder country, further and farther from roads. It was kind of like the powerlifting days. I wouldn't have missed that for the world. It was an extraordinarily intense opportunity for a young hunter to go up and down the mountains from way before daylight till way after sunset and lie down, take a nap, get up and do it again the next day and on through a 5-week hunting season. Earlier if you're bow hunting, it was magical. It was tremendous.
You write about how... Well, this is how you put it in one of your essays. In hunting, every footfall matters. Like there's a choice that you have to make. You have to be. I don't know. It sounded to me like as you're putting it, it's like extremely elementally intentional. As you say, you have to choose where to direct your senses. Say a little bit more about that, because there's another part of this essay that I thought was really sort of spoke to that kind of intensity. You talk about your senses being engaged to the point that it seems like, this is how you put it, the tips of your cell receptors are glowing incandescent. It's like you're burning, you say, without actual damage.
That's how it feels. You know, art is selectivity, and so many of my passions have been like the act of writing. It's as if, even though I didn't study writing, I learned how to write or how to be a writer through weightlifting or through football, where you're trying to, you know, find areas of openness on the field to exploit, or go one direction to get the flow of the game going in that direction. Then everything that I've done with passion seems to have created a model for how to write. When I was an oil and gas geologist, you know, looking for buried oil and gas, you know, with just a few clues, two or three pieces of data, and constructing a map, a narrative of where the oil was, where it migrated, where it finally got trapped. That's, you know, where's the end of the story? Everything I have done with passion has seemed to apply toward how to write a good story, I think. You know, the hunting business, every step is intentional, and the cant of your body with relation to the wind and to the sight lines and to being obscured, staying hidden or unobtrusive in your journey through the forest. You do think about those things early as a hunter, and then, you know, as with any repetition or practice or craft, it becomes more instinctive or unconsidered and just subconscious. And that's when things get really interesting as a hunter, where you eventually come up on an animal and you think, wow, what luck. I can't believe the animal allowed me to get up there. And you were just inhabiting a state and a condition where you were occupying the same place and time that the animal was. And there the two of y'all are there finally one day standing, you know, next to each other.
Well, it gets us to the essay you include in the book about Hemingway. You write about Hemingway that, you know, he was a hunter, of course. But you say he's probably a hunter before he knew he was a writer. That sort of step-by-step that you're talking about, you know, you say in the same way, step-by-step, Hemingway, you say, polished his brain into that generator, as you say, that would power his craft. Will you talk a little bit more about that, that he was a hunter before he knew he was a writer, and how being a hunter polished his inevitable craft as a writer?
Yeah. I do think, you know, the young Hemingway, his keen attention to specific detail in the out-of-doors, in the natural world, as it's referred to, did sharpen in him, I'm sure, a pre-existing condition of wanting to control hyper-detail the existence and observation and experience of everything that he could. And if one is going to hunt, one is looking keenly and intensely for one's quarry and is selecting one's approach. So I can see how that might have kind of built the muscles in his mind that would eventually be converted to writing rather than hunting or killing.
I think the part about that essay that interested me the most, though, was that other aspect where hunting may have informed his writing, and maybe even the way, I don't know, you write as a hunter, and that's death. Death and, as you say, learning how to end a story, knowing when a thing is over. That's also how you put it in that essay. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I'm trying to craft my answer to speak to a non-hunter, and am struggling to do so. Very few people have ever been able to successfully describe what it's like and why.
Yeah.
But what I can describe is what writing is like. When you get near the end of a story, the story announces it's the end of the story announces itself. It's a product of structure, of narrative momentum, of conflict, the rise and fall of tension and release of tension, the resolution of conflicts. The end, as they say, writes itself. And so often in writing, a writer may think, oh, this is where I am going with this. This is where I think is going to be the end. And the writer skates past it or travels past it or overshoots it. And what's really wonderful as a writer is when you begin to develop a sense for what the blood feels like, what your pulse feels like, what the sound in your ears, you hear the end approaching. You know you're in the company of the end suddenly, and you learn to slow down and look around and maybe even pause and see if the end will come with you, which it usually does. And that's just a really gratifying transition out of the subconscious of the writer into the consciousness of the story. Hunting is sometimes like that when you're really in it and you worked hard to get into good country and the country just keeps getting better and better. By better and better, I mean more and more conducive to housing, holding the residence of the animal you're looking for, and in the conditions, time of day, everything. And you're aware, oh, I'm very close now. And you may not smell the animal, you may not have heard it, you may not have seen any tracks, you just know. And very often, sure enough, you take a few more steps and there it is, there he is, just waiting, or so it seems.
I want to come back to beauty for a moment, because you've written about your own kind of aesthetics for beauty. And one of the things that you mentioned, the reason I have to say this is on my mind and sort of I'm drawn to this, is there's some weird kind of symmetry going on. We had this conversation last week on the show about beauty, as a matter of fact. We talked to the physicist Brian Greene, among others, about it, because there was this symposium going on at the University of Utah. And so I'm thinking a lot about beauty. And so it was interesting to hear you or see you write about your own aesthetics for it. And one of the things you mention is that you think of beauty as a kind of fittedness. The way – this is how you write it. You write, the way a thing integrates or seeks to integrate with everything else in its environment. I never thought of beauty in that way. But could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I thought about the word beauty a lot because I don't like it. I mean, as a writing instructor, if I had a nickel for every time I wrote show, don't tell, or SDT on a manuscript, I could bail Donald Trump out of his woes right now if I was of a mind to, which I'm not. I want to practice specificity, the great quote by William Carlos Williams, no ideas but in things. You know, I think is a way of saying, show, don't tell. Don't tell me a thing is beautiful. Show it to me. And so the idea of beauty is an abstraction that I would rather, paint with a certain color of paint, yellow, umber, orange, ochre, burnt sienna, or, talk about a sand grain being, 0.02 millimeters of silica between larger than a clay particle and much smaller than a cobble, blah, 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 being specific. But the fittedness, that is, it's so hard to talk about these things without using abstractions. Usually the things that are beautiful in the natural world are products of deep time. It's been my observation. And deep time is back to story. It's a struggle, a conflict with resistance and desire, and the accommodation of the pollinator and the blossom, or the prey and the predator, the hunter and quarry, the snowshoe hare whose bone ratios are the precise percentages, as are the bone ratio and lengths of the predator, of the Canadian lynx. The overlap, the symmetry between things and the dynamic equilibrium in which they coexist, that generally, when we see those things, we generally say, wow, that's beautiful. And those things usually fit their environment really well. And it's taken them a long time to achieve that fit. And we don't know why we call it beautiful. But more often than not, it seems to have a quality of fittedness to it, an earned fittedness, again, against across deep time. There are exceptions, of course. You know, the asymmetrical can be deeply beautiful, and it may fit, but for a moment. It may be very temporal, but it does have an existence that's come as a result of conflict. That's a tough one. Yeah. Back to you, Brian Green.
Well, you know, this idea of natural equilibrium gets me thinking about another essay in the book where you, I don't know, you put this interesting spin on evolution where you wonder about this countercurrent, as you describe it, to evolution, and that maybe this is something that Darwin missed. You say, what if we, instead of sticking with this idea that strength and domination and survival is all that matters, what if we consider, and these are your words, what if we consider tenderness? What if we consider wisdom? Or what if we consider the dignity of the moment? Work me through that idea, if you would. We should make it clear, as you do in the piece, you're not religious. This isn't a religious argument, but you do write in the piece that we sometimes defy evolution. So what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about religion. Darwin was, you know, was a struggle for him to be a scientist and religious. I think he was an incredible scholar, thinker, philosopher, scientist, natural historian. He got the ball way down the field. I mean, but that was a long time ago. And I think there are still lessons to be learned from his observations and from the natural world. He could not have foreseen that the world would take his writings and apply them to, you know, to a social Darwinism of survival of the fittest. But, you know, back to that word of fittedness, survival of the most beautiful.
Yeah,
a little bit, but also survival of the luckiest. I mean, when you go to the Galapagos and you see, you know, the tortoises, each one on each island, having just even in the short span of several centuries, having significantly different morphologies, you know, based on the vegetation of the different islands, you know, seven different islands, like a day of the week, you realize it's not that the tortoises are so cunning or fit or strong or clever as are just the forces of life in that strange little place where volcanic activity in the middle of nowhere happened to create you know, a little dab of clay or burnt rock, basalt, that would be at the confluence of three major equatorial currents, bringing a steady stream of nutrients to those smoking ruins of new land and very consistent solar radiation there on the equator. It was just a perfect lab for life. And that wasn't survival of the fittest. That was survival of the luckiest. I mean, those tortoises were there in that strange place in the world because sailors coming back from long trips who'd carried the tortoises with them for emergency meat, they were getting nearer home and they thought, okay, we don't need these stinking things below. And they just throw them overboard and they bob and float in those currents and they would get drawn to land. They would land on these little islands out in the middle of nowhere. They were just lucky, that's all. And so back to, you know, your idea or your reading of the passage where I wrote about grace and the wisdom to know that your existence is not predicated on your strength. We're not strong. We're lucky to be here right now, and we are a brief experiment far off of the center of the tree of life. We're way out on the branch. There's nothing quite like us. We build fire, and we make musical instruments. Those are about the only two things we do that other things don't do. And so that's why we're here. You know, everything is here because it does something well and does something singular. And the average length of any species, all species, is about 9 million years. And we're what, 180,000 years young? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say humility and humbleness is would serve us well in our new foundling stage.
What do you mean when you ask in this section, is there an evolutionary path for faith?
I love thinking about that. I think everybody, I've never heard anybody come up with an answer, you know, free will or destiny.
Yeah.
I think the most interesting responses are somewhere in between the two, sometimes one, sometimes the other. But, you know, what engineers and physicists refer to as a forced move in a designed space. I kind of suspect that's the condition of life. I mean, you read Stephen Jay Gould in his book, It's a Wonderful Life, where he argues, and I think quite successfully, that, you know, roll the dice and start over, and the world would look so different than it does today, even with the same conditions, the same designed space. There was a species, Animalcharis, you know, a soft-celled organism floating in the mid-level of the Devonian seas, and all the rains of that time, the mudslides were just creating this consistent, steady slurry of sediment into the oceans that blocked out the sun and silted up the bottom, and anything at the bottom died and anything at the top died, and this little Animalcharis floater that would later evolve into a segmented organism that became vertebrates just survived by luck again, not by cunning or strength. And it gave rise to, you know, a great many wonders. Every vertebrate that ever lived came from just being in the right place at the right time. Is that destiny? Is that fate? Or is it a forced move in a designed space? Yeah, I have no answers. Do you?
No, I don't. I think the point, of course, to me anyway, and this is the thing that you work through in an essay when you're reading it, as I have been with yours, is working through the idea. You don't need to come up with the necessarily the answer right now, but the fact that you're considering faith as an option in a conversation about evolution is interesting.
I mean, the great Matheson quote, "Have you seen the snow leopard? No, isn't it wonderful?"
Rick Bass, he has a new book with a collection of essays that span nearly 30 years. It's called With Every Great Breath. What do you worry about most, like right now? Let me give you some options. Democracy,
okay.
Climate change, AI, civil division, people challenging truth in institutions. Like, what do you worry about most right now?
That's How did you like the play, Mrs. Lincoln? I think it's a red herring to say that I would worry about democracy, because I don't think we have inhabited democracy for a long time. I do worry about Trump. I think that's the thing I worry most about, the pseudo-theocracy that he represents. I worry about the inability of our populace to think two steps ahead to the consequences of this dalliance with, you know, the charismatic ugliness of him. You know, climate change, either we adapt or we don't. You know, the AI, we survive or we don't. There's plenty to worry about, but I think Trump hastens game over for so much beauty that I think it is a battle royale, and we shall see what comes. You know, 5 swing states, 13 voter districts determine the fate of the green living world.
It seems like you're more worried about grizzly bears than Donald Trump, though.
If I think grizzlies have 20 years, and I think we have, you know, just a handful of months with the execrable one. I do. I mean, I'm worried about Black Ram Forest. It is occupying my energy and my creativity and my advocacy and my fear, my concern of losing this one forest, because it represents so much. If we can protect it as a doesn't represent, it is so much. If we can protect it as a climate refuge, the first in the country dedicated to storing massive amounts of carbon and long-term safekeeping of ancient forest conditions, and then create a chain of them, a loose necklace of them around the northern latitudes, a halo or necklace of green, a curtain of green, to use Eudora Welty's phrase, that necklace, that curtain, can absorb up to 12% of the world's carbon emissions each year. That buys us time for all of the things we love about life and the living and those we love and care about. So that's my work, is to defend that forest so it can become an example for all the other forests like it to connect and be protected. That's the specific, but it kind of addresses your question about, you know, the specific versus the abstract, you know, grizzly bears versus long time. This one seed became one tree, became one guitar from one forest, and we have been advocating to various representatives in key positions of power in Congress, one of whom is the incredible climate leader, Shelley Pingree of Portland, Maine. And we have a lot of supporters of our forest in her district. We've been doing a lot of presentations. It's public land and national forest, and we've been very active in the Portland, Maine area, have a lot of friends there, and they have advocated through Democracy to Representative Pingree, who at the time was chairwoman of the House Appropriations Committee. And she was saying, she was puzzled at first, like, why are all my constituents writing about this obscure forest in northwest Montana? You know, we've got lobster issues, we've got education issues, we've got all these issues close to home in Maine. Why are they so on fire about protecting this forest? And to her credit, she penned a letter to Biden and the Forest Service that would become later the genesis of Biden's executive order directing the Forest Service to protect all old and mature forest on public land, some 100 million acres worth. That came from this one little tree, this one big tree, and this one guitar. And then from that, we can connect this curtain of green. That's the specific. That's what I think about, is we have to win this. We have to, if we can keep the earth healthy and healthy and slow the rates of extinction, we can veer in a different direction than the one we're going toward. We're not going to get out of this alive. There's going to be great damage and great harm. There already is. But we can stay between the lanes, between the lines, if we stop Black Ram.
I want to come finally to one of the essays that you include toward the end of the book. And I guess the question is, what do you put in a letter to the country? The name of the essay is Letter to America. And one of the things you say is, like, it might be interesting or provocative to talk about Donald Trump, you know, or the American fetish over guns. That would be interesting. But you say something like that could become as antiquated as a time capsule. So what do you say in a letter to the country right now? Because you don't want this to be a screed about what's wrong. What do you want your letter to America to be about?
I mean, it sounds so cliche to say, remember our priorities and gratitudes. Why are we so angry? We're angry because we're afraid. What are we afraid of? We're afraid of losing the things we love. So why not work harder at celebrating and defending our passions, our specific passions, not the ideology of fear, but the ideology of love, of generosity, of giving rather than taking. Again, I do a lot of teaching, and I teach a lot of young people, and I am so excited to see how hungry they are for this message of leadership, of assuming leadership. Like, it's really easy as a young person to say, this is what's wrong with the world, this is how it got screwed up, and this is everything that sucks. There's no time for that. Yeah, tell me something I don't know, says the comedian David Sedaris, following up with an obscene or profane punchline that cannot be uttered on public radio. But yeah, that's what I would say, is remind me what it is we're fighting for. You know, what is it you love at the end of life? What is it you want to see continue existing after you're gone? And what can you give in service of defending it?
I think the idea that kind of resonates also in that essay is that you kind of imagine this conversation with America. You write this, you write, I think of if America were here at the table with me on this porch at the end of summer and the beginning of fall, I think I'd fix her a meal and I wouldn't feel the need to preach or complain. I might even tell her that I'm grateful for her. I might read some poetry to her. And you imagine that at some point in this conversation, she says, what's going on? She asks this. She's at some point, eventually the way the conversation goes, you wonder here, is if she may ask, how can I help? So you're envisioning this as an exchange, as a conversation, and eventually she's going to ask what matters to you. What matters to you right now is grizzly bears or whatever it might be. But I don't know. I just thought the way you imagined this as a conversation, you know, at the end of summer, beginning of fall, and you maybe read her some poetry and make her a nice meal. I don't know. Will you just finally say something about that, the way you've constructed that?
As I mentioned, I think art will, this is an opportunity for artists to become leaders in our culture and in a time of fragmentation and paralysis. People with big passions and big ideas must and can and are emerging to give us direction where we've lost direction. With regard to the idea of it being a conversation with our past and our future, I think we have created a country. I don't mean with the boundaries, rivers and dashed lines and boroughs and districts and such. I think we've created a country that is a definition of the time and place where we are. We have created her. We have created America. She was here before we were and was wiser. And we have had, it's been a rough relationship. And I think we are both fatigued, time-tested, battle-tested, and but committed to survival. And I mean, when I'm in the old forest, it's much like that. It's not a conversation, but I'm aware of another system that is alien to mine, my species, but is not against me, that is willing to accept my existence. And I think that's where we are with this country we've created. It may not love us, but we have history. We have a future, and we are collaborating. We do have a relationship, and we have a responsibility to ourselves and to each other in that relationship. And it's time to have some conversations with no bullshit in them.
Rick Bass, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug, as ever. Always a pleasure.
Rick Bass, his new book is With Every Great Breath. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can email us with questions or comments. We're at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.